It is just past 18 hours, 32 minutes and 15 seconds East African time. Time for John Sibi Okumu on Wednesday. This being Wednesday, the 22nd of March, 2023. Hamjambo na karibuni. Hello and welcome. I must say, it feels good to be back for the first episode of a brand new series. On the 12th of December this year, our country will turn 60, which gives us good enough reason to aim for, but not necessarily limit ourselves to, retrospective conversations on just how far we have travelled in various spheres on the road of independence. About 2 weeks ago, my first guest, a mystery till near the end, a ploy to which you have become well accustomed, took me and a gentleman called Abdurrahman Waberi, a celebrated writer originally from Francophone Djibouti, on a guided tour of Nairobi's Eastleigh area. The visitor wished to rub shoulders with the Somali community, which is predominant there. Somalis and their place in Kenya will be the focus of our discussion. In 1963, many Somalis had a great wish to secede from Kenya in what would have meant a redrawing of colonial boundaries in order to become part of a greater Somalia. That failed to happen, and today, with the devolved system of government, Somalis live within a surface area in Kenya that could take in several small African countries. And they form the majority in three counties, Garissa, Wajir, and Mandera. In the capital city, the 2 square kilometers that make up Eastleigh are home to a transnational business hub, and Somalis are becoming increasingly visible in other neighborhoods throughout the land. Somalis are equally well-placed politically, with 30-plus MPs and senators in the current parliament. And the list goes on. Not bad for a grouping that initially wanted out. And doubtless we will learn much more. Ndugu, do you have any memories of December the 12th, 1963?
Of course I do. I was relatively young at that moment, but 1963 turned our world upside down. And because when Kenya was celebrating independence, Africa was celebrating the independence of a new African state. We were pulling the other way. We were on the run. War had broken out in the northern region of Kenya. And many of us became victims of that war. And I remember fleeing with my parents to the border town of Isbania, entering Sirari. I became a refugee with my family on the day Kenya became independent. We were not there to celebrate because the majority of the northern Kenyan people, the Somalis and some of the Oromos, had opted not to be part of Kenya. And remember, Kenya is an artificial creation. It was created by the British as a colonial project, and various African communities were put together into that country. But northern Kenya remained an emergency-controlled neighborhood under the control of the British military. That part of the country never became part of Kenya culturally, socially, and economically.
Well, to my memory, that was what we knew as the NFD, the Northern Frontier District, and there was also reference in those days to Northeastern Province, and it was fundamentally a no-go area. But to come back to this whole idea of belonging, which is going to be a running theme in our conversation, do you think that there was something to be said for a redrawing of these boundaries, in which case you'd have felt immediately at home and continued to do so?
Yes, because we were part of a landmass. of a community with one language, one religion, one cultural focus, from the Red Sea, the Indian Ocean, all the way to the borders of the Kenyan Highlands and the Ethiopian Highlands. And these communities remained homogeneous over hundreds of years until the arrival of the British. You shouldn't forget that the coming of the British to Africa was very recent.
Could you go back further than that, Ndugu? I mean, to the accusation, how is Africa? This is Africa. You are talking now, ni Arabu, and talk wapi hao watu. I realize, Ndugu, that that's something of an unfounded question, because you end up being what you are. But what's the history of that? And where are your affinities?
No, the Somalis are an integral part of the African people, the African continent. They form the Cushitic group, which also consists of the Oromos, the single largest ethnic bloc in Ethiopia, present-day Ethiopia, the Afar people. And we have inhibited and occupied the land of the Horn of Africa for thousands of years. During the Pharaonic period, it was known as the land of Punt. And this was the land that used to produce the frankincense that was used for the mummifications of the pharaohs, and later was taken over by Jews and Christians, used in their religious rituals. It originally came from land of Punt, which is in present-day Somalia. Ibn Battuta, the famous Maghrib is part of Algeria, Tunisia, and Morocco now, a scholar and explorer, visited Mogadishu, which was a thriving city, in the 13th century. And in the 14th century, the Horn of Africa had relationships with the Middle East, with the Arab world, with Persia, with India, and China. And the famous Chinese explorer and admiral, Zheng Hu, traveled all the way to the coast of the Somali coast, and the Swahili coast of East Africa. And the Somali region had a diplomatic representation in the court of the Chinese kingdom at that time, in central China. So it's an old civilization which has been in existence. Because we have interreactions with different parts of our continent, and the Middle East in particular, and Asia, and because Somalis are predominantly Muslim, there is a perception, and people, you know, can believe whatever they want. You cannot stop what they want to believe. They look for evidence that confirms in what they think. They don't look for evidence that helps them to understand the situation better. And often, this is informed by rumors, innuendos, and negative beliefs. You can have your own views, but you cannot own your own truths. And the reality is that the Somalis are African. They have lived in Africa. They are part and parcel of the larger Horn of Africa and East Africa. And they're here to stay as a community and contribute to the cultural, social, economic, and the political life, not only of Kenya, but East Africa, because they have pockets in Tanzania. The Tanzanian Minister of Agriculture, for example, Bashir Hussein, is a Somali. You have them in Uganda. You have them in Southern Africa. So they are pastoralists and people who've moved around in many parts of Africa. But in Kenya, they have always been part of the Kenyan story and the Kenyan project.
I'd just like a bit of comeback on the statement about these designations of Bantu, Cushitic, Hamite. I've heard it said in certain quarters that they are also an invention of the colonialist to make it better to divide and rule us, that none of us are Nilotic or whatever. So what's your view on that as a scholar?
No, of course, if you look at, if you do anthropology, social anthropology, they are linguistic groups. For example, now, as a Kiswahili speaker myself, I have seen the strong relationship Kiswahili has with other African people. If you go to Addis you wouldn't hear in the vocabulary of the Amhara or the Tigrenya or the Oromo any words that are originally in Kiswahili. But when I go to Tanzania, when I go to Malawi, when I go to Zambia, when I go all the way to Southern Africa, I can understand. For example, when I was living in South Africa, I could easily understand some of the words being said in Zulu because they were using very words that were common in my Kiswahili language. For example, ndovu is ndovu, nyati is nyati, and many other common things. And even in Eastern Congo, you would find languages that are very much related to Kiswahili. And I believe that this Kiswahili is rooted in Bantu. It's not rooted in Cushitic, which is my other language, the Somali. So I do believe there is Bantu, there is Cushitic, there is Hametic, there is Nilotic, because of their and even their features clearly show that. But okay. It may have been used by the colonial system to divide us, but it is not a colonial invention. Kiswahili right. is not a colonial invention.
Right, with respect. Mm. I think, you know, because we're going down memory lane in 60 years. So I just slightly more succinct, because there's so many things that I wish to ask you. One of them being on this question of nationalism, the idea of the African Renaissance, the African resurgence, and the idea of nationalism. You've just said that as a nomadic people, Somalis were like Maasais, like other people, they're not the only ones, like the Hausas. Is it possible to have a national identity across borders when your DNA affiliation makes you kin to the person across the border on the other side?
Yes.
If your cousin comes across from Djibouti, are you going to kick them out and say, our border rules say stay out?
Of course not, because I believe colonial borders are imposed. Identify us. They don't represent us. And for example, comfortable.
Yeah, Ndugu, we fail to integrate in the sense that we're trying to look for African solutions. I want to pitch it to the idea of you being a thinker. Should we adopt another way of defining ourselves other than the passport, where yours is green and mine is red, and never the twain shall meet?
Absolutely, because I don't think we as Africans can make any progress in reaching economic prosperity and stability without coming to terms with our and dealing with our colonial borders. You know, these colonial borders were created by the colonial forces to serve a particular purpose, which is to exploit, to extract minerals, and to use the cheap labor provided by the African people. It was not intended to create a bigger, a stronger Africa. And as if you see now with the formation of the African Union, the East African Community, our aspiration is to get out from the shackles of colonialism. And I think it is perfectly all right for me to be a Somali in terms of my cultural identity, and to be Kenyan in my nation state identification. There's no contradiction between the two. The two are not competing. One is not killing the other or the vice versa. I'm stronger, much stronger with my own culture and language, being part of that bigger Kenya. The same thing that I also have very strong support for ethnic languages. For example, Ngugi wa Thiong'o's view on languages, that I'm very proud to hear a Mugikuyu speak in his language on radio and television, play his own music, instead of playing the traditional country music that has been brought by the colonial or the cultural imperialism that we have in many African countries.
Ndugu, asante sana kwa tutasimama kidogo tu. A short break. Ndugu, I'd like to draw you on my own limited perceptions, and I hear that in the history of Somalis, the idea of a very painful past on this road to having the achievements that you have now, and we'll come to the achievements, the idea that in your history the books refer to massacres, massacres of your people. Could you give us a very short, in your own words, resume of what those massacres were and why?
Well, really, when we had when Kenya got its independence, and the Somali population, significant numbers of them took up arms, the response was a violent military reaction against that uprising, which in the Kenyan state language is known in the shorthand of the Shifta War. And a lot of Kenyan kids studying our history do not understand what the Shifta War, because Shifta in Somali and the colonial language is banditry. So although the assumption was that Kenya was fighting a banditry conflict, just similar to what is happening in Turkana, Samburu, and Pokot at the moment, it was a major political uprising by the people of that section. And the response of the government to that has been very brutal. The government adopted a scorch earth policy in which it fought and killed a lot of people in major human rights violations, unspeakable atrocities. And some of the signposts of this brutal period in our history is the series of massacres that now people use to describe them. And it started in Garissa. There was the Bula Karatasi massacre, in which hundreds and hundreds of people were killed, many of the bodies thrown into the Tana River. There is the Malkia Meri massacre, which happened in the Mandera area of northern Kenya, in which another thousands of people were displaced and many, many hundreds were killed. And the most documented one, which is the Wagala massacre in Wajir, in which over 5,000 people are said to have perished.
What year was that?
That was 1984. March 1984.
Exactly.
Yes. So, and these are terrible periods in our history that are that mark the incorporation of the Somali region into Kenya.
And there is no desire in a Western style scenario where you want to go back and have commissions of inquiry and reparations. Is the attitude you have as a Somali, forgive and move on?
No, not at all. Not so, for me.
Yes,
I feel that terrible injustices had been committed, and the same feeling I have about the Mau Mau, the Kenya Land and Freedom Army, the incarceration, the killing of the Kikuyu, Embu, Meru people during the War of Liberation in the 1950s, is that thousands and thousands were killed. The entire Kikuyu population was put into concentration camps and suffered unspeakable atrocities and human violation of their rights. There has never been closure to that particular subject. And I think it is important for the healing and for nation building in this country that there should be a government that one day would acknowledge the atrocities and the terrible things that have been done to that community, and to bring closure, to apologize.
Sorry, so you're trying to suggest, Ndugu, that to say awful things happened, I wasn't there, but I apologize, brings closure to a contentious issue.
And maybe some kind of reparation to those communities.
Right.
The same with the case of what happened in northern Kenya. The nearest that we had got an apology was President Uhuru Kenyatta coming into the National Assembly of the Republic of Kenya and saying the Kenya government apologizes for those atrocities, and then a pledge to give reparations, to spend 10 billion shillings in rebuilding and healing that community. But that never happened. No money or no development projects were undertaken to address those issues. When I'm talking about reparations and bringing this to closure, I don't mean just monetary benefit. It is just human beings are sometimes satisfied with, I apologize to you, I wronged you, please forgive me, is enough. It has happened in South Africa through the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. It has happened in many other countries through transitional justice, It doesn't have to be a tooth for a tooth or an eye for an eye. It is not. It doesn't mean digging and opening up the wounds of the past.
Right. I still go back to our overarching theme, and that is 60 years. It's not a society that became so many years before Christ or before Muhammad. We're talking about a young nation. And in this young nation, as we go forward, I would imagine that Somalis in the very recent past, just before COVID, there were roundups in Isli and people taken over to stadia and kept overnight. And there's this great sort of hodgepodge of refugee camps, Dadaab, Kakuma. How do you as a Somali respond to this targeting of your people?
Well, it is terrible. I mean, we have experienced and we have lived through profiling, dehumanization, targeting. And particularly whenever there is a crisis in our country, it is always easy to have a scapegoat and to point a finger at the Somalis, and nobody else would be bothered because they are considered to be guilty of the crimes they have been accused of. And they say that when the hyena wants to eat its children, it makes them, you know, smell like a goat, and therefore it becomes
self-justifying,
palatable. Yes. For you to be able to eat your children. And the Kenyan state has done that a number of times. For example, during the Shifta War, a lot of the victims were civilians.
Ndugu, the history of it, I would say, thank you for telling us the history of it. But I'm interested in this notion of transformation and change. So I'm sure on December the 12th, there's going to be tremendous fireworks and celebration. Is this another day where you don't know whether Somalis might be tempted to flee once again, as you were as a little boy in December 1963?
No, I don't think so. I think a lot of things have happened. I regret the fact that, in fact, in 2014,
yes,
the government put an emergency status. Isli was put under siege, almost under military rule. In order to fight the so-called extremism and terrorism. It was a terrible mistake. It should have never happened, and we fought against it.
I have Somali, Ndugu, I have Somali friends who are busy going off on a trip to South Africa or something, and their hard luck stories that they're stopped at the airport and said you can't travel because, you know, you're not in order. Now, that doesn't happen to the great mass. You know, I don't see that happening to me somehow. Saying, you know, I'm just headed from Busia County and I'm going to New York and say, don't travel.
Yes, of course.
So you're being mistreated. So in the great scheme of things, let's keep to our big topic. Where do you see this change coming for a grouping, which is not a minority grouping? Somalis are not a minority grouping.
Because
for the census,
they were a minority.
But you could be, according to some census and according to people say that the numbers are rigged, but there could be at least 3 million of you. So that's a lot. But
yes.
You're being mistreated.
Yeah, because of our historical legacy. Even when you're getting a passport,
yes,
you have to be vetted. If you want to get an ID, you have to be vetted. And only this week, the government had made a decision. The president had said that there would be no more vetting. He doesn't want any more vetting of this particular community. He doesn't want more profiling. So we are moving incrementally.
But we're still living in a society where some animals are more equal than others. In Orwellian fashion.
Of course. I mean, I think the mentality of the state, the Kenyan state, which is based more or less is an inheritor of the colonial state, that mentality needs to change. That mindset of people, the Somalis, been othered, been demonized, that has to stop. And I think we're making progress towards raising our voices to make such kind of prejudice not acceptable in our society today.
Time for another break. 18 hours, 58. How about that? Go for a break. Ndugu, the big picture. You and I are of a generation to appreciate the big quote from Kwame Nkrumah, who said, seek ye first the political kingdom and all else will follow. Now, it seems to me that your community, the Somali community, has chosen the economic kingdom. They have bought themselves into legitimacy. If I wrote my PhD with that as an overriding construct, would you accept it?
Yes, I would agree. But I think getting into economics and in business, it was not a matter of a choice. They didn't have representation. When we became independent, we didn't have members of parliament from Northern Kenya for a while. We were completely neglected and underdeveloped. We had a war, and we have faced the worst elements of climate change, drought after drought, famine, a completely neglected and invisible society as far as our region was concerned. So circumstances have forced this community to look for alternative ways of survival. And that alternative way of survival has been to get into business and do their own things. And to a certain extent, they have also taken advantage of the changes that have taken place in Kenyan society. Kenya is the most liberal and open economy in the East African region. And Somalis seems to have gone into that like fish in water. They seem to do very well. They seem to prosper. They have skills. And the crisis in Somalia also has helped in some ways, because when the Somali state disintegrated in the 90s, a significant number of Somalis with knowledge, with capital, sought asylum in this country. And they were able to link up with their Somali brothers here to take advantage of this opening in the Kenyan economy, where they started investing in business, different types of businesses. And they seem to have done very well. And together they have been able to create an economic power that is increasingly becoming visible in Garissa, in Wajir, in Nairobi, and even beyond beyond Kenya. And so I think you would say that the economy has become the salvation of the Somalis, and a ladder for them to climb into getting better education, to getting better access to state services, getting access to state positions and so on. And therefore, it seems to have worked very well, because they wouldn't have been able to do very well politically, because at the beginning they were a minority. And the education level, the level of education, the level of knowledge in that community was limited. They were left much behind. They didn't have even a secondary school until the 1970s. The first secondary school was built in 1974 in Wajir. So they had to run in order to catch up with the rest of Kenya.
Well, let's look at the rest of Kenya and the whole notion of devolved government, the boundaries that we have. You're trying to suggest a model of progress that is very insular. We keep to ourselves. We largely, people are peripheral to our activities. But if you have a boundary of some sort of county that takes in people who are not the same ethnic group, the Nilots are face to face with the Bantu, is this a recipe for disaster? Should everybody follow the Somali model? Kikuyus for themselves, Luyas for themselves. Here's your stipend in this budget. Go ahead and build yourself some schools and hospitals.
No, but I think they were forced by circumstances. For example, look
they,
at...
They being whom? Are we talking at cross purposes?
Yeah,
no, I'm trying to tell you to extrapolate
yeah, but that's,
your
that's
experience.
The point I'm just coming to, because
do.
I didn't grow up in Northern Kenya. I grew up in... I'm from Nairobi, and I grew up in Western Kenya. The quality of schools in Western Kenya are not to be found in Northern Kenya. And your schools in Kakamega, in Bungoma, in Busia, were built by the missionaries. If you go to Maseno is a school that was built by the colonial system and the missionaries. Alliance was the same. The Somalis simply didn't have that opportunity. They were not part of the colonial system. They were a buffer zone kept away from the Kenyan highlands. They were kept. There was a Somali line where you couldn't cross to come and live in the rest of Kenya, or vice versa.
And so, I believe there was a Somali passport, which was sort of
There was
a different color.
There was a Somali kipande, the pink card.
Yes, which was
so
different.
This was a segregated, discriminated society. They had to find their way into Kenya, just as much as the only thing that Kenya did was it said you are part of the Kenyan territory, but it hasn't invested in that region to the extent that you would see major development until very recently with the devolved government. So they had to do self-help.
I take your point entirely.
And that self-help,
I'm saying, should peoples do the same?
You know, this is the experience of many diaspora communities.
Yes.
If you look, the Jewish community, the Indian community, circumstances determine the progress and the development of those societies until such a time when you need to break out. Now, Somali businesses no longer require Somali clients, no longer require Somali capital. They're everywhere. They're in the energy business. They're in the telecommunication business. They're in the aviation business. They're in the banking business. And they're in partnership with other like-minded stakeholders from other communities, from other nations, maybe even foreigners, not necessarily Africans. So I think it is, we're talking about stages of development, stages of breaking out to make something out of your lives. And I could see a good example is the Indian community. You know, nobody is building schools for them. Nobody is building hospitals for them because they are a minority within themselves. But they have been able to excel in economics, build their own schools, build their own hospitals. And we use the Aga Khan was a community project, but it is a hospital for everybody else now. MP Shah is originally an Indian hospital, but now is a private enterprise. Any client with money can use those services. And the same, I think, with the hotels, the restaurants, the hospitals and schools Somalis are developing. One day, it'll be a competitive school in any part of Kenya.
Please allow me to level yet another accusation. It's so nice to have an articulate apologist. And I'm going to put this question to you, that the manner in which the Somali community does business is for a bit of sheng, ni geugeu, ni offline, nini amujitendi vizuri. So what's jibu ilo swali nalo?
But
jibu kwa Kiswahili, kwa Kiswahili.
Unajua kwamba kila jamii ambaye inainuka, ambaye inafanya maendeleo, ambaye inafika kwenye kiwango ambacho ulikuwa huitegemei, utakitafutia kitu cha kuwachafua, kusema kwamba pesa zao si halali, hawatoi kodi. Lakini wewe uniambie sasa hivi tuko hapa Kenya. Na Wasomali wanaleta containers maelfu na maelfu kila siku kutoka nje. Hizo containers hazitozwi kodi na KRA. Zinapita wapi? Ujiulize. Ni kwamba hii ni porojo na uongo ambao unaenezwa na wale maadui ambao hawafurahii maendeleo ya jamii fulani.
Ndugu, I'll give you the answer to that. It has something to do with the whole notion of corruption, in the sense that if you buy me off as the whatever department, you can bring in your containers, but we'll share the loot.
But it
won't be for the general welfare of the country at large.
But you want to tell me that the Somalis,
yes,
are the only community whom you think would, of which habits and behaviors of that are reserved.
But
Because it is not.
What I would say,
corruption is a Kenyan problem.
Yes.
And it affects every community. You don't want to tell me that...
Ndugu, all I'm saying is, for you as a philosopher and a thinker, you have the idea of a role model. You have the idea of, I'm going to emulate this person. If I see my next door neighbor making great strides by stealing... every day into his garage he comes in and he's bought an SUV and he's living in Runda. Is that what you're encouraging the rest of the nation to do?
No, but there is
because you were trying to sort of say this is legitimate because you had no alternative.
I want to tell you that is absolutely not true.
Yes.
There may be corrupt elements in that community. just as there are corrupt communities in every other community. But I think you cannot stop people from believing what they want to believe, even when it is completely false. So I do not believe that the thousands of God-loving, law-abiding Somalis are involved in the vices that their enemies or their adversaries point to. I believe it is purely jealousy, it's purely competition, some community feeling bad about another community, and that is what has been fed into the grapevine, and you hear quite a lot. But I want to challenge you, let any of those vices that you're mentioning be exposed by our media. We have an independent, open media. We are a very open country. Why don't they expose those vices that are committed by that particular community? Other than, you know, you give a dog a bad name in order to beat it up or to kill it. So it is the same old story of jealousies and rivalries and competition, healthy competition between communities.
One more accusation, please. It's 10 past. We've got 5 minutes to the next last segment. The accusation that terrorism, that with Al-Shabaab, the ongoing war, all the nasty things that are happening with university children being killed in the north of Kenya, every Somali is a terrorist. Now, I could answer that question myself, but I'd much rather you did it on your own.
Yeah, behalf. But obviously, that is not true, because Al-Shabaab is a terrorist organization. But is it a Somali organization?
I'm asking you to explain.
Is it a slum? No, but I'm trying to answer.
It's worth listening to this program, maybe it's for that reason.
Terrorism has no faith. Terrorism has no ethnicity. Terrorism has no ideology. It's simply a belief system. And if you can see Al-Shabaab now, Al-Shabaab is growing beyond the borders of Somalia. You have people from Mount Kenya. You have got people from Busia. You have people from Uganda, all the way to Congo. And this has been fed by elements who feel disadvantaged, left out, not getting the benefits of the development of a country or the political benefit of a country. These are marginalized. They come from marginalized communities. These are individuals who feel excluded from the resources of the state, left out. And they are everywhere. It's not uniquely a Somali thing. It's there's nothing Islamic about Al-Shabaab either. I mean, a lot of young, disgruntled, angry people are joining them. And as we sit now here, there is a very big segment of Al-Shabaab that is multinational, that cuts across borders, cuts across even religious lines, because a lot of people are joining for beliefs that they are fighting for the right thing. So I don't think that you could actually put Al-Shabaab as uniquely a Somali thing that a lot of the Somalis support. Otherwise, it would have been everywhere. I think the majority of Somalis are law-abiding. They support them. They're happy to be here in Kenya. They're part of the Kenyan story. They want to be part of the Kenyan success. And that's exactly what they're doing here. They're getting integrated rather than being a separatist. The tendency among Kenyan Somalis, the majority of Kenyan Somalis, is integration. You know, as we speak, the defense minister of the Republic of Kenya is a Somali. You want to say that a community with the defense position in the country, with the top military brass in the country, is interested in joining Al-Shabaab or fighting for terrorism or for lost causes? No, of course it is not true. This is propaganda. This is disinformation. This is fake information that you are trying to spread by putting that label on a whole community.
Ndugu, asante sana. One last break before we come in for the end. We find out who you are, for one. Ndugu, I just before we find out who you are, I'd like to hear some comments about where we started off by visiting Eastleigh and this hub, the largest shopping mall in Africa, so it seems, when it goes up. How was there, again, a model to be emulated by? Is there, as there is a Chinese model, an Ethiopian model, is there a Somali model of business?
Oh, yes.
What is it?
If you look at the Garissa Lodge model, which is now taught in business schools, is a model in which you start small and medium, and then you have a collective, you have a group of people putting their resources together. If you look at before the colonial...
The small print is that the people come together, it's insular, only Somalis can play this
because
game.
Because it is...
You're
it
not
is
going based, to ask me to be a
No, it
a
is
shareholder.
Based on trust.
It's based on trust. And you can only trust your
yeah,
fellow...
You're an outsider. You cannot... Yeah. You know, the cultural norms and the values and the principles of every society are different from others. And there is a belief system. And also there is a justice system. For example, there is no contracts that are signed between businesses. It is resolved through the maslah system, which is also, again, an indigenous justice system. Yes. So you have to be a part of a value.
And that system,
a value chain.
That system decrees that with no, my word is my bond.
Yes, absolutely.
And what happens to the person who breaks that bond?
That is a terrible. You become a pariah.
Yes.
You become a pariah who is completely not able to function without the community. You have to disappear from that community because it is not acceptable. Although that tendency is increasing now because of modernization and people are developing other values and other principles. But that is the central system that brings together. So the Garissa Lodge model
has... How would you guarantee within the Somali community that a young teenager is not going to be polluted, so to speak, by social media and dress codes? Where's that happening?
No.
I can see that in the future there's going to be an erosion of this bedrock that forms your society.
That is already happening because a lot of the young people are going to different neighborhoods, they're going to different schools, they have friends across ethnicity and the cultural barriers. So it is happening. I mean, as you modernize and you become urbanized, you would have to face that problem. And many diaspora communities have faced that problem everywhere they go. So the Somalis are not an exception. But so far, there is a homogeneity and unity among those who work together. And the Garissa model has come into the CBD. It has gone to other parts of Nairobi. And you can see Somali businesses that are thriving all over because they're based on those very good, honest principles of doing the right thing in business, and making sure that you don't cut corners, you don't cheat your partner, and so on. That model has worked so far, and it is expanding even globally. I mean, if you go to Minneapolis or to London, you would see Somali neighborhoods with Somali malls and trading centers, which use the same kind of principle of association and accumulation, and do their businesses.
Now's the time for me. Kwaniwe nani? Who are you?
Unataka nikwambie kwa Kiswahili.
Anza na Kiswahili.
Mimi naitwa Yusuf Hassan Abdi. Sasa hivi mimi ni mbunge wa Kamkunji, eneo la Nairobi. Nimekuwa mbunge, nimechaguliwa tena kwa mara ya nne kama mbunge wa Kamkunji katika uchaguzi uliopita. Mimi ni mwana Nairobi, mwana Kamkunji, na kwa muda mrefu nimekuwa mtangazaji katika idhaa mbalimbali za hapa nchini na za nje, na pia nimefanya kazi katika nyanja za kimataifa katika bara mbalimbali ikiwa ni Asia, Afrika, Mashariki ya Kati, Ulaya na Amerika ya Kaskazini.
Allow me to be your interpreter. In short, you are the fourth term Member of Parliament for Kamkunji. Your name is Yusuf Hassan Abdi. You've had a great career in broadcasting, and you've also worked for the United Nations. If you would allow me to be a bit personal, when I see you, I think of another gentleman whom I've had the pleasure as a broadcaster of interviewing, a South African man called Albie Sachs. Justice Albie Sachs, and the mythology around him is that he was blown up and lost an arm, and he still soldiers on. Now, Kenyans will associate you as the member of parliament who was the victim of a bomb attack, perhaps not targeting him directly, but it certainly went close enough to blow bits of your body off, and you had to have that reconstructed. I would ask you the personal question, that's scary stuff. What does it take psychologically to come from such a brink and be the vibrant soul in front of me in the microphone?
Well, I mean determination, not to give in to evil doers, not to give in to people who want to break you, destroy you. And Albie Sachs is actually a very good example. He was blown up in a car bomb in Maputo in Mozambique during the apartheid regime. Remarkably, although he lost an arm and suffered horrendous injuries, he was able to survive, and I was able to meet him in London. I was involved when I was in London with the anti-apartheid struggle, Namibia, Zimbabwe, Angola, Mozambique, and South Africa. And I was able to engage with him. And then when Namibia became independent, he came over to Namibia just before Nelson Mandela was released. And I've always admired his resilience, his courage, and his determination. And I never thought one day I would also myself be a victim of a terror attack. And one of the things that kept me going,
I'm not sure I'm saying anything. Thank you.